Hey, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:31, May 14th. May 14th, class is almost over, one more week. Actually, only besides today, one more lecture next week, and then your test. So we're going to look at the schedule first off. We're going to finish up, you're going to celebrate. We're going to finish off urinary system and move into diversification system today. So let's look at the schedule first. Here's the schedule, and we said today's the 14th. We're going to get into diversification system, and then 1 week from today is your last exam. It's not a cumulative final, just like a regular exam, same period of time. What is that, hour and a half, something like that. But here are the chapters, 19, 20, nothing's omitted, 20, 20, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, and you know some of these chapters are really short. They probably should have combined like four of them into one chapter, but anyway, they're like that. All right, don't forget, those people that have Monday labs, you have your fourth practicum on Monday and then a quiz after that. And the Wednesday labs will have the lecture exam and a practicum. So if you're the morning lab, you get the practicum first and then the lecture exam. If you're the afternoon lab, like people are going to go to lab this afternoon, then you'll have the lecture exam and then the practicum and a quiz afterwards. That's just the way that goes. Any questions on the schedule? And what could be on the final? Just the study guide. Study guide is the key, right? And as far as the practicum is concerned, what's your answer key for the practicum? Your lab manual. Yeah, that's where all the answers are, just right in your lab manual. So just kind of first memorize that lab manual, find those different things, and you're going to be really good. Okay, anybody have any questions for whatever we went over last time? We went over some kidneys, but first, we're going to see if there's any announcements from SI. Sweet. Do you have a red marker by any chance? Okay. All right. So last time we looked at the structural and functional unit of urine formation. And what did we call that beast? Yeah, the nephron. Right? So we want to be familiar with the nephron. And when you think of a nephron, you should be able to break it down into two major components. What are the two major components? Yeah, tubular elements and vascular elements. So let's just start right over here for tubular elements. And just like mitosis, make sure that you have that complete list, and also make sure that you know what is the first tube that some kind of filtrate moves through, and that's connected to the next one and the next one. So I do want you to know the correct order. So what is the first tubular element? Yeah, it is. Okay, glomerulus contains blood. So I don't want to put that in a tubular element. Bowman's capsule. All right, and as a matter of fact, probably I'll put in parentheses right here. What is the fluid in a tubular element? It's going to be filtrate. It's going to start as filtrate, and then it's going to be processed into urine. All right, and it should never contain any red blood cells. It would be really a bad sign. Could be nephritis or some kind of damaging blood pressure on the nephron. It's not going to work if red blood cells get into the tubular elements. Okay, so you have filtrate in Bowman's capsule. Name the process by which filtrate enters Bowman's capsule. Tell me the name of that. I didn't mention it yet. Okay. The name of the process by which this fluid enters Bowman's capsule. It is called filtration. All right, so filtration produces filtrate. Okay, all right, that's not too bad. We're going to actually draw this out in a little bit. Bowman's capsule. Now, what's the next tube? I think I heard it over here. Connected to Bowman's capsule is proximal
And it has a lot of twists and turns. Convoluted tubule. All right, and it's a tubule, so it's a kidney tubule.
Now, what kind of fluid is in this proximal convoluted tubule? Yeah, filtrate, not blood, right? And if that fluid stays in the tubular elements, you lose it from your body. Anything that's in that filtrate, if it doesn't get processed out, it stays in that fluid, becomes urine, and you excrete it from your body. All right, the next segment of a tubular element is the, descending loop of somebody, Henle. What's in the descending loop of Henle? Filtrate. And then we have the ascending, I'm writing really fast, loop of Henle. What's the fluid in the ascending loop? Yes, filtrate. Ascending loop, and then another convoluted tubule. Convoluted, and I'm just going to abbreviate T. All right, now this one is far away from Bowman's capsule, so it can't be the proximal, it is the distal. So that's a nice hint that the convoluted tubule that is attached to Bowman's capsule always has to be the proximal convoluted tubule, right? And it's easy to trace because it connects up to Bowman's capsule. All right, then after the distal convoluted tubule, then that fluid moves into the collecting duct. And at that point in time, there's very little processing left to do on that fluid. And so we should really consider the fluid in the collecting duct, not filtrate, but urine. All right, so that's a little bit old hat. You might be getting a little bit bored with this, but I want to write this down because I need to layer some important concepts on this. All right, so then what's the second component? Vascular. Vascular elements. And so these are tubes as well. Now, what's in these tubes?
Blood.
Yeah, that's blood, not filtrate. All right, so there are capillaries in a nephron, and you have to think of a kind of blood vessel that brings blood to a capillary. What brings blood to a capillary? An arteriole, right? A tiny little artery, that we call an arteriole. All right, but we got to be specific because there's a couple different kinds of arterioles. And this is the afferent. Yeah, we want to go in the right order of these things. So, afferent, arteriole. And an arteriole always brings blood to another kind of blood vessel, which is a capillary. What's a capillary specialized for?
Exchange.
Yeah. Now, this capillary is so special because it's a very leaky kind of capillary. It's not a continuous capillary like what you're familiar with. It's a fenestrated capillary. So, and it has a special shape. It looks more like a meatball than a network. So we give it a special name, and it kind of looks like a globe, this capillary. So we call it the glomerulus. Glomerulus. And this is where important kind of exchange takes place. So it's got to be a capillary. All right, so that's a capillary. And I'm going to put a hashtag right here because we need to do some counting on these things. All right, but don't forget, that's a capillary. And, you know what? I got some room. So what happens in a capillary?
Exchange.
Right? But since this is such a leaky capillary, it's a special kind of exchange. We call it filtration. So filtration also happens here. And I'm sure you've done some filtration today. What kind of product did you make by filtration?
Coffee.
Yeah, coffee. We took some water, coffee grounds, mixed them together, maybe heated up the water. And most people in the world like to separate the coffee grounds from the fluid that they drink. Some people don't, but usually we do. So we use a coffee filter, put the coffee grounds and water on top of the coffee filter, and what goes through the filter is what we call the filtrate. All the big stuff stays out of the fluid that you're going to drink. Right? So that's what filtration is. Pretty much passive. And it's the things get separated by size of the molecule. So small molecules end up in the filtrate, Large things stay in blood, like red blood cells, white blood cells. Large proteins stay in the blood. They don't end up in filtrate.
All right, so that's a capillary. And then the capillaries send blood to an efferent arteriole. And where does an arteriole send blood once again to? A capillary. And these capillaries are called the peritubular capillaries. And what's the function there? And you should just say this without thinking. Exchange, right? All right, but now this is not capillary. This is what in the counting capillaries, what number of capillary is this? Yeah, so this is number 2, which means that the glomerulus is capillary number 1. All right, and in the usual circulation, after blood goes into a capillary, where does it go on its way back to the heart?
A vein, a little tiny vein that we call a venule.
All right. All right, so you might notice something funny going on right here.
In the usual systemic circulation, we have an arteriole, a capillary, and a venule. You don't have two capillaries back to back, but in the nephron, you've got two. You've got the glomerulus number 1, peritubular capillaries number 2.
Can you remember, what do we call this system right here, whoops, with 2 capillary beds before the blood goes back to the heart?
Yeah, we saw it between the hypothalamus and the anterior pituitary. Where else did we see it? All between the digestive tract and the liver, right? And we call that a portal system.
Portal. So this efferent arteriole is a portal blood vessel taking blood from one capillary directly to another capillary.
And you're going to see why that happens in just a little bit. So is that everything? I think that's everything. That's pretty good. So we got to draw this out really quick. All right, so let's start. I always like to start with the tubular elements. The first tubular element is
Bowman's capsule.
I draw it big. All right, and what's the name of the fluid in Bowman's capsule?
Yeah, filtrate. Filtrate. And then that fluid moves into the proximal convoluted tubule, into the descending loop of Henle. Wow, I don't know what color marker this is, but it's really easy for me to see. Ascending loop of Henle. What color is this marker? I got to get more of these.
This blue? Just regular old blue? I thought maybe it could be purple or something. Yeah, it's blue. Okay.
Okay. All right, so ascending loop of Henle, and then some more convoluted tubules here, and that goes into the collecting duct, CD. So here we have urine, right? Oh, and we didn't label this. How would you label this? DCT.
Right.
All right, so those are all the tubular elements, no problem, right? Okay, vascular elements contain blood. Blood goes into Bowman's capsule. Name of this vessel that brings blood in? Afferent arteriole. And then here's the meatball. That is glomerulus. All right, another blood vessel comes out. Here is the efferent arteriole, and that's the portal blood vessel. So if here's capillary number 1, here's an arteriole, that goes to another capillary, right? Kind of like this, and it goes all over the place, and then finally, like to renal vein, right? Or you could call that a venule if you want to. Don't care so much. Ah! These things here are what? Peritubular capillaries. All right, and what's a capillary for again?
Exchange.
Right, okay. So we got exchange here and exchange here. Peritubular capillaries are pretty much like a regular capillary. They're not fenestrated. They're not sinusoidal. But they don't leak very, very much. Okay. Well, in the process, here I have some markers. I didn't see those before. In the process of making urine, all right, we got 3 steps. Which is not bad. First step. Black marker? Do you have a black one though? This one is a little anemic. Okay, make sure I give all these nice markers back to you. I left all mine in lab.
Okay, 3 steps. The first step you already know. Okay, and we call that filtration. Yeah, filtration.
Where does that happen? in Bowman's capsule, right? In Bowman's capsule, which means that there is fluid in blood, and it gets pushed out of the blood into Bowman's capsule.
It goes like that. Okay, so this is
number one, filtration.
Fluid and solutes, water and solutes go from blood into the filtrate. And then that filtrate moves around through all these tubules.
That's number one.
Okay, so what is a small molecule that can be filtered? Well, water is. Salt. All right, like NaCl is salt. And glucose, for instance. And another thing, for instance, like urea.
Now, what can you tell me about some of these compounds? What about water? Is that good to have in your body?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely, right? Because you don't want to dehydrate. What about salt? Is that important? Absolutely, because these things carry electrical charge. We call these electrolytes. You have to have the right balance of these things to maintain the electrical properties of your body. Got to have that. Okay, and sugar, glucose, is that important for you to have? Yeah, that's an energy source. All right, and urea, what about that? That's a toxic compound. Your body should get rid of that. The kidneys can get rid of it for us. All right, so we got water, salt, and glucose, things that our body needs, but it gets filtered. It goes into the filtrate. And if it stays in the filtrate, where does it end up? In urine, and then you excrete that from your body. Right, but those are the things we want. So there's a second process that after things get put into the filtrate, right? So they're in these tubules right here, the kidney tubules. There is a process that can take materials, right, from the filtrate and put it back into the blood. This is number two. Okay, and we're going to call this tubular resorption. Process number two. So what are things that we want to resorb? Water, salt, glucose, sugar. We don't want to lose that. And as a matter of fact, so much fluid gets filtered, so much water gets filtered, right? If that was to produce urine, you would dehydrate probably in just about 5 minutes. So most of the water that is filtered has to be resorbed and put back into your body via the peritubular capillaries. So we'll talk about how this kidney functions in just a little bit. All right, now, with this process of filtration, we see that we're throwing out some good things that we want to put back in our body via the process resorption, but not all of the toxic compounds that are in blood get filtered. Some remain in the blood, but we don't want it in our body, so guess what else the kidney can do? It can take compounds that are in the blood that are toxic, like urea, and put them into the filtrate. This is process number three. And so one, two, three. Count it backwards, sorry. Three, two, one. One, two, three. All right, and what is number three? Okay, three is called tubular secretion. So here's a nice diagram, but I want to finish this off just a little bit by writing down which is the what direction these materials go. So for filtration, how do things move for filtration? They start someplace and end up somewhere else. They start in the blood. Yeah, they start in blood. And what fluid do they end up in? They end up in, I'm going to fall off, filtrate. All right, good things and bad things get filtered. But you don't want to lose good things, so that's why you have this process here, tubular resorption. Which way do materials move for tubular resorption? Filtrate to blood or blood to filtrate? Filtrate to blood, and you can see it with these arrows. Right? Make sure you get the direction of those arrows just right. All right, so number two is what? Filtrate to blood. Filtrate to blood. So let's jot that down.
filtrate to blood. And how does that relate to filtration?
Filtration is the opposite way. Filtration is what? Blood to filtrate. Resorption is filtrate back to blood. All right, this third one, tubular secretion. For instance, what does your body want to get rid of? How about urea? Would be a good thing. That would be a good example. So urea in the blood gets secreted into the kidney tubule, and then where does it end up? In urine, and you lose that from your body. All right, so that's process number three. So which way do materials move? How do they move? Filtrate the blood or blood to filtrate? Blood to filtrate. Blood to filtrate. So harmful compounds. Or Memorial Day weekend coming up, you might be drinking a lot of margaritas loaded with salt. You need some salt, but when you're drinking margaritas with a salted glass, you're overdosing on salt. So not only is urea secreted, but excess electrolytes can also be secreted. All right, so excess. Excess what? Salt? Maybe acids as well, like hydrogen ions. Okay, so excess things that your body doesn't need that can become toxic are secreted as well into the urine. So the urine is highly variable depending on your diet and exercise and all of that kind of stuff. Question?
Excess,
yeah, too much. Over the limit, above the limit, yeah. It happens in all three of those places, even the collecting duct a little bit, and it's variable how it does that. Okay, in the proximal convoluted tubule, it's working 100% all the time as far as water resorption and salt resorption, as much as it can, and glucose resorption. It's doing as much as it can possibly do. And if it can't do enough, then the other parts of the nephron, including the collecting duct, can make fine adjustments in resorption to bring your body back to where it should be. Okay, so sometimes if the proximal convoluted tubule is doing a good enough job, then the rest of the nephron doesn't have to work for you. But if the proximal convoluted tubule gets overloaded, then these other parts here can help you out in terms of resorption of some things, water and salt. Okay, glucose pretty much gets resorbed everywhere, but the nephron can only absorb a certain amount of glucose, and if it's above that level, all right, then glucose can't be resorbed, put back in the blood, and if you have so much glucose in the blood, it can't be resorbed. It ends up in the urine. What do we call that condition when glucose ends up in urine? Because you have so much in your blood, it can't be resorbed. That's called diabetes mellitus. All right, somebody has diabetes, their blood sugar is so high that the nephron can't take all the glucose that's in the filtrate and put it back in the body, and then you lose that important metabolite in the urine. So what would that be like? Glucose is an energy molecule that's like the gasoline in your car. So that would be like going to the gas station, filling up your gas tank with gasoline, and then taking an ice pick and putting a hole in your gas tank. And then it's going to dribble out on the ground. Right? All of that energy, all that glucose should be put back into the blood. But when somebody has diabetes mellitus, they can't do that because there's just too much glucose in the filtrate. Okay. So what else do I want to say about this? Okay, only these three steps. Filtration, resorption, secretion. So in this filtration step, the glomerulus and Bowman's capsule can't make a distinction between harmful compounds and essential compounds that you need. Everything gets thrown out. And then the job of the rest of the nephron is to bring back into your body the important things that it needs, glucose, water, some salts. Okay? And not all the harmful products can be filtered, so the rest of the job of the nephron is to get rid of many of the toxic compounds that it can, like urea, for instance. So that's the job of the nephron. Only those three steps. That shouldn't be too bad. Okay? All right. So who's got a question on that nephron? Anybody got a question on the nephron? Another question on the nephron? All right. So what does your book have for you? Yeah, your book has a pretty good diagram. Sorry, where is it? I'm going to have to flip back to it in just a second. It's a nice illustration. Right here. Okay, so look up on the board. Maybe I'll turn the lights back down just a little bit. Like that. This is good. All right, so what do we have right here? We have the nephron. I can see some vascular elements, and I can see some tubular elements like Bowman's capsule and a kidney tubule. And since it's connected to Bowman's capsule, I would say this is the proximal convoluted tubule, but it could be any tubule in the kidney. So the first process is what? Things moving from blood into Bowman's capsule. Number one is filtration. All right. And a lot of good things get filtered. Everything that's small, every small molecule gets filtered and put in Bowman's capsule, becomes filtrate, and if it stays in filtrate, all these good things, where does it end up? In urine. All right, so your body has to recover all that water or you will dehydrate very, very quickly. So process number two, material moving from a kidney tubule going back into the blood, right, around these peritubular capillaries. So that is resorption, tubular resorption. And not all toxic compounds get filtered into Bowman's capsule. They stay in the blood, but your body wants to get rid of them, and it can via a process called tubular secretion. So what kind of compounds can be secreted? Give me some examples. Urea, which is a breakdown product of proteins. It has a nitrogen. It's a very toxic compound. And excess things like excess salt or maybe excess acid is another thing that can be secreted. Give me some things that should be resorbed from the filtrate and put back in the blood because you don't want to lose it in urine. Water and glucose, for instance, and even to a large degree salt as well. Okay, so you shouldn't lose all the salt that's in the filtrate as well. Okay, anybody got a question on those three processes? Pretty nice and simple. All right, so how does all this stuff work? Well, look what we have right here. All right, we have a proximal convoluted tubule, and the proximal convoluted tubule is connected to, in front of it, proximal to the proximal convoluted tubule is Bowman's capsule, right? Or sometimes it's called the glomerular capsule, which means the glomerulus is inside there. So here is Bowman's capsule, and it comes around over here, and then here is the glomerulus, the capillary, and notice that the Bowman's capsule actually then touches the surface of those capillaries, right? And then it comes around back over here and makes the wall of the glomerulus. So when you look at this structure, I want you to think of this as a special kind of membrane, right? And remember, what are the two kinds of membranes that you had to know something about? There's a membrane that lines a cavity to the outside world, open to the outside world, and a membrane that lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world. Serous one, yeah. So a membrane not open to the outside world is a serous membrane, open to the outside world is mucus. And this one, to me, resembles a serous membrane. What are the three components of a serous membrane? The visceral, right on the organ, and parietal, which is right on the outside. So here's the parietal division of Bowman's capsule, and when it comes over here, it lies on the surface of these capillaries. This is the visceral division of Bowman's capsule, and you see it changes structure a little bit, and then here's the parietal division once again. So these special cells that make up the visceral division of Bowman's capsule, you can see are very special. They have all these projections coming off of them. They're not continuous like we see the rest of, like on the parietal layer of Bowman's capsule. They have big spaces between them. Right, so let's zoom into this region. And here's that afferent arteriole bringing in blood. Here's efferent taking it away. All right, so we're zooming in. Here is the endothelium. of this particular capillary. We said it was a fenestrated capillary, which means that it has these relatively large pores in it, and it has relatively large intercellular clefts, which we can't see on this diagram, but there are big spaces between those endothelial cells that water and all small molecules can leak out very easily. All right, so this is a nice fenestrated capillary. And then right on the surface of the capillary is this additional layer, right? This is the visceral division of Bowman's capsule, but it's not continuous, right? Because it has these big processes and then these smaller ones that fit together with large spaces between these foot processes, right? So and the cell, because it has all these like foot processes, we call it a podocyte, right? Okay. And these spaces between the foot processes are what we call filtration slits, which again just aid in exchange, in particular the mass transport of small molecules. Here's a nice electron micrograph. And you can see we're not really making this stuff up. There it is in real life. Here's an illustration of that particular membrane. So here's plasma in a blood vessel. Here's that endothelium. It's a fenestrated endothelium. Here are some large pores. So fluid is going to be pushed out and all small molecules are going to be pushed out, move through a basement membrane and then through the filtration slits of the podocytes, all right, and then all of that fluid ends up over here, right, and it ends up over in this spot by size. Small molecules pass through, large molecules and cells stay on the other side of this membrane. So since we're separating by size, what's the name of that process? Like what you'd made coffee with?
Filtration.
And so what is the name of that fluid that you drank this morning, whether it's tea or coffee? It is?
Filtrate.
It is filtrate. Yeah, the coffee was really the filtrate. So this material here inside Bowman's capsule now is called the filtrate, right? And it's got harmful things and helpful things, and it's the job of the rest of the nephron to make changes, right, in that filtrate so that you resorb helpful compounds, necessary compounds in your body, and also you can secrete harmful compounds that still are in the blood, because not every harmful compound can leak out. So that's sort of an interesting process. All right. If you have a garage, maybe you can kind of relate to this process a little bit. Okay? If you have a garage, I don't know, there's probably not many people in here that can park in your garage. Because why? It's filled with all kinds of valuable stuff that you just can't throw away, right? Because you can't park in your garage. But if one day you're going to be really serious about moving your car into the garage, what's a really good way of doing it? Open your garage door. Here's one way. Open your garage door, grab one item, hold it up, look at it, and then decide whether or not you can live without it. Right? And if you can't live without it, you put it back in the garage, or if you can live without it, you put it out on the curb. Then you grab the next item. Right? That's process number one. Or process number two, you just close your eyes, open up the garage door, and take everything that's in your garage and move it out. Okay? And then only put back in the garage exactly what you need, and then everything else you throw away. What is going to be more successful for you to park in the garage at the end of the day? Pick up one thing at a time or remove everything? You know, remove everything and then just put selective features back. And that's exactly what the kidney's doing. It throws out almost everything, right? But then it puts back just what your body needs. That's the job. So it might seem a little futile, but just kind of relate to it maybe in your own everyday life. That's a better way of processing material. Okay. Well, we said, we're going to change topic a little bit. We said that one of the jobs of the kidney is to regulate blood pressure by adjusting fluid volume. So if you're becoming dehydrated, then the nephron is going to resorb more water from the urine and put it back into your body, and urine is going to become very concentrated. It's going to be very, very salty. If you're well hydrated and drinking a lot of water, then the kidney will be able to secrete a lot of water or excrete a lot of water. So urine will be a very large volume and not so salty. It's going to be mostly water. So it can make a lot of different kinds of adjustments. When it makes those adjustments, it regulates your blood pressure. So think of this. Think of a car tire. You have your car tire, and you want to increase the pressure in that car tire, do you take air out or do you put air in? If your tire pressure is too low, what do you do with air? Put it in, take it out. Yeah, you put it in. All right, this is a nice, easy way, and it's not too far wrong. It's a nice, easy way to think about blood pressure. All right, so your kidney can feel the blood pressure, and if your blood pressure is low, what do you think the kidney will want to do? Take water from the filtrate and put it in the blood, or take water that's in blood and put it into urine? Should the kidney put water into your body or take it out when your blood pressure is low? Yeah, it should put it in. Okay, I said, yeah, just as I had a difference of opinion. Okay, so when your blood pressure is low, kidney should put water back in your body to raise your blood pressure. If your blood pressure is too high, kidney should take water out of your blood and put it in urine, and that will reduce your blood pressure. Okay, so kidney is important for controlling blood pressure. Here is one of the ways that it does that. Let's look at some anatomy. I'm going to have to put this away and this away. Okay, so here we have, you're familiar with this. Here is Bowman's capsule, right? And here's that proximal convoluted tubule. And here I see a capillary. What's the name of that capillary inside Bowman's capsule? Yeah, it's a glomerulus, right? And it's a nice fenestrated capillary, so it leaks a lot of fluid, produces a lot of filtrate. So here is the afferent arteriole. Notice the afferent arteriole is a lot thicker than the efferent arteriole, because you could actually consider these things like the precapillary sphincter that you find in other capillary beds in your body. But we call these granular cells, and it just so happens, let's look at this illustration of a nephron right here. So here's Bowman's capsule, and coming out of Bowman's capsule, how would you label this twisty, curvy tube right here? That is the proximal convoluted tubule. Then you got the descending loop, ascending loop, and look where that ascending loop brings that kidney tubule back up to the glomerulus. And so now we're in another twisty tubule. What is this twisty tubule right here? The distal convoluted tubule. And look where that distal convoluted tubule goes. It goes right up against the entrance to the glomerulus, right in between the afferent and efferent arteriole. So there's a special communication system between the fluid that's in the kidney tubule and these blood vessels right here. And that will help regulate fluid volumes in your body, and therefore will help regulate blood pressure. So what are these things? Well, this is what we call the juxtaglomerular apparatus, because it's right next to the glomerulus. Okay, and it's got some different divisions. Okay, part of the wall of that distal convoluted tubule is what we call the macula densa. I see it right here. Okay. And then over here, this is the wall of the afferent arteriole. These are what we call granular cells. Sometimes we call these JG cells. So what is the function of these things? Well, I have it listed right here very nicely on your slide. Right, the granular cells, which are part of the afferent arteriole, they're measuring something. Okay, and they're measuring blood pressure. When blood pressure falls, it secretes a compound called renin. And renin is an enzyme that will boost blood pressure back up. And I think you really need to maybe take a physiology class to see how that happens, right? But it's these cells right here that release renin, and that converts some things that are already in your blood, and that can help cause vasoconstriction in some parts of your body, and it can help resorb water from the kidney tubule and put it back in the blood. So when that renin causes resorption of water from the filtrate, puts it back into your blood, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up. But what was the initial stimulus? A fall in blood pressure. So this is something that will help maintain your blood pressure within normal ranges, right? When it starts to fall, these JG cells secrete renin, and it will bring your blood pressure back up by taking fluid that would end up in the urine and put it back into the blood, as well as some salt, too. Okay. The macula densa cells, right, that we see, macula densa cells, okay, right here, macula densa cells, right here, and the distal convoluted tubule. Okay? They contain chemoreceptors. So they can measure chemicals, and what they measure is like the concentration of salt in your body. And actually, not in your body, but in your blood. All right. And as your blood volume decreases, it becomes more salty. So when these things are triggered, right, then it's going to tell the JG cells to release renin so that your body resorbs water and it brings the salt concentration back to normal. And when that happens, that will also increase blood pressure. So this juxtaglomerular apparatus is very important in adjusting fluid volumes and how salty your urine is and how much water is lost from your body. But in the long run, what that means is that this part of the kidney is help regulating blood pressure via the juxtaglomerular apparatus. Yeah, they work together. You know what? These granular cells can work on their own, but they work better in concert with the macula densa cells. They work better, more precisely. Because these granular cells right here can secrete renin, which will increase blood pressure. Okay, through a really nice mechanism that people in physiology get to learn about. Not so much in here. I see some other kinds of cells between the tubes within the glomerulus, and we call these mesangial cells. They probably have some kind of function because they're there, but in some cases we just don't know what the function of cells are, and this is a case that we just don't know what these cells are doing. And it might have something to do with regulating blood pressure. I'm not too sure. Nobody really knows for sure. Okay, so if you say juxtaglomerular apparatus, what's the take-home message that I want you to know about? What organ is it in? Juxtaglomerular apparatus. What organ is it in? It's in the kidney. Yeah? And where? What's the location of that juxtaglomerular apparatus? Right at the entrance to the glomerulus, right? And because the distal convoluted tubule scoots right by, there's a special communication between the distal convoluted tubule and those arterioles. And it's just monitoring components of the blood, monitoring components of the filtrate, and then it's going to tell the body how to make adjustment to help maintain water in your body, salt concentration, and blood pressure within the proper range. All right, so that you remain in a healthy state. So that's the juxtaglomerular apparatus within the kidney, right in this region here. Yeah, so that's really, I think, the important thing that I would like for you to know. And guess what? That's it for urinary system. Woohoo! How many? How many processes are necessary to make urine?
Three.
All right, not too bad. What are they? Filtration, number one. Resorption number two, and secretion number three. Okay, not too bad. And when all that happens, right, that helps maintain blood pressure, helps maintain electrolyte concentration, water concentration in your body, and it gets rid of harmful compounds that you shouldn't have in your body, like excess acid and urea, for instance. All right, the other thing you should know, what's the structural and functional unit of urine formation called?
Nephron.
Yeah, nephron. And now you know some pieces of it. So if you know how one nephron works, you pretty much know how all nephrons work. Oh, you know, with only one exception. I'll show you the exception just so that you're not blindsided if somebody asks you something about this at some point in time. Okay, you have basically two major groups of nephrons. Let's take a look at this slide right here. Wow, that didn't make it any more simple. All right, so here we have the kidney, right? We've got the medulla with the pyramid and column. And then here is the cortex. There are some blood vessels that separate the cortex from the medulla. Anybody recall what those blood vessels are? They arc over the base of a pyramid. They're called the arcuate, arteries and veins, right? So they're right here. And I see them right here. Right here are the arcuate artery and vein that separates the cortex, which is here, from the medulla, which is here. Do you see that there are two different kinds of nephrons? Both nephrons have Bowman's capsule in the cortex, right? But one has the loop of Henle only going into the medulla a short distance. The other one has a very deep loop of Henle. It goes way down into the medulla. So these two nephrons have slightly different kind of function in the body. They all have filtration, resorption, secretion, but this one down here, all right, so this one, the one that's mostly in the cortex, we just call that a cortical nephron. This one that's shared pretty much equally between the cortex and the medulla, we call these the juxtamedullary nephrons, and these right here are very special because they can make very concentrated urine. So if you have a lot of salt in your body and you become dehydrated, this is the kind of nephron that can get rid of a lot of salt and put the most amount of water back into your body, the juxtamedullary. So that's the big difference. And that juxtamedullary, instead of having just a regular peritubular capillary, the capillaries that it has a special name called the vasa recta. And I can't remember if that was a question at the end of the chapter or not. It might have been. So I think I'm glad I mentioned that. So vasa recta capillaries are in the juxtamedullary, and they're therefore secreting a lot of salt and urine. Or another way of thinking of that is returning a lot of water back to your body to prevent dehydration when you're in a dehydrated state. All right, so that is the last thing. Now you can celebrate. Ooh, thank you, thank you. Me too. All right, so that is the urinary system. Any questions on that? You can also ask me next time if you have a question on the urinary system. But remember, urinary system essentially is really simple because how many main parts are there? Only four. Kidney, ureter, urinary bladder, urethra. All right, but don't forget about that nephron in there. And that special first capillary, the glomerulus. All right? Okay, so that's it for... Now we get to go to the diversification system. And I think that is chapter 25. It says 24 here. That's because they reordered the chapters on us. Okay, so I don't want that. I had it here. Okay, I got to go get some pictures. Some pictures. What happened to my pictures? Chapter 25. All right, here we are. Some pictures. So I'll put this over here. Okay. So what's the function of this reproductive system? I've asked some classes that have had lab already, and oh, they didn't really help me out. What's the function of the reproductive system? Yeah, to reproduce, and you know what? I disagree with that. I don't like that as a good reason. Yeah, it says in your notes, to create something new and unique, right? Because if you look around the whole room, do you see another you anywhere? You see a lot of humans in here, but is there another you? There's no you in here. And if you went to a place where there's 100,000 people, like Coliseum at a football game, and you look at every single person there at the football game, would you find another you? And the answer would be no. And as a matter of fact, if you went over the whole world and looked at everybody, would you find another you? No, you would not find another you. So what I consider the importance of that reproductive system is that it produces always a different person. Right? We call that diversification. We'll find out why that's important in just a little bit. Okay, another way to think of this is, another thought anyway, is since your mom and dad produced you at some point in time, and it's possible for you to have an identical twin, so they could produce really two of yous at one time, but can they produce two of you separated by maybe 10 years, 15 years, or 20 years? Can there be like identical twins after 10 years or 15 years? And everybody's shaking your head because that has never happened, more than likely. But you know what? It is possible that it could happen, right? If your parents produced you at one point in time, they could, why can't they produce another you sometime later? They could. But the chances of that happening are so astronomically low that it probably has never happened and will never happen, right? And the reason why is because our reproductive system is very complicated. So some of us have a penis, some of us have a vagina, some a scrotum, right? Some uterus and an ovary. So it's really, really complicated. And the reason why we have all those complicated structures is basically to make sure that everybody that's born is new and unique. Now, why is it good that everybody's new and unique? We talked about a couple of disease processes that I thought were really strange, really, really strange. Two disease processes, because they affect everybody in the population if you live old enough. Can anybody think of any of those disease processes? And I find that strange because we're all different. So why is there a disease process if we're all different affects everybody? What was the name of one of those processes? How about osteoporosis? Okay, if we live long enough, all of us are going to lose bone density. Our bones are going to get weaker and more brittle. It just so happens that if some of us have bigger, stronger bones, we can afford to lose more bone before they get really, really brittle. But if you have relatively small bones, okay, then that becomes a really serious issue. But everybody's going to have osteoporosis. And that's strange. Why? Because we're all different. What's another thing that everybody's going to... we haven't talked about it yet. We're going to talk about it in this chapter. I'll talk about it right now. And it has to do with a prostate gland. And females don't have a prostate. Males do. And this is another one of those strange things to where if a male is lucky to live long enough, the prostate is going to misbehave. It's just going to grow. It's going to get bigger, and you're going to see that it grows right around the urethra, and as men get older, they have difficulty voiding urine from the urinary bladder because the prostate gland gets so big. And that happens to just about everybody. And why is that strange? Because everybody's different. All males are different. Right? So the reason why we're different is because we all deal with disease and disease processes differently. So if there is a flu going around, and it could be a deadly flu, is everybody in this room going to get that deadly flu? No, because we're a diverse population. Some people will be more resistant to it and can live right through it, right? And others won't be so lucky. So the reason why everybody is different, because we are, that's just, it makes the population very strong. It can resist a lot of different kinds of disease processes. Some of us will live, some won't, okay? And the kind of reproduction that we go through is what we call sexual reproduction, so that we're all different, and we're going to learn about some of the structures that make that happen, as compared to other kinds of animals. For instance, there's an animal called a hydra. It's a water animal, and it's got a bunch of tentacles, and it's got a tube. On top of the tube, it's got a mouth, and it can grab like food particles and stuff it in the mouth and lives its life that way. But when it reproduces, it just starts to grow another little hydra on its side, its trunk. Okay, when that little hydra gets big enough, it breaks away from the parent hydra and becomes another hydra over there. But now that hydra is, what's it like compared to the parent hydra? It's exactly the same. So if the parent hydra is susceptible to some kind of disease, what happens to the offspring hydra? It dies too. It gets wiped out. Right? So the whole population can get wiped out if it doesn't reproduce sexually as a result. So that's why diversification is so important. How would that be if all of a sudden you're walking down the sidewalk or going to class and you feel a little bump on the side over here? Okay, you get home, bump's a little bit bigger, right? Wake up in the morning, it's even bigger, and you decide, well, I better take a look at that bump, and you look there, oh, and there's another you growing there. What would that be like? And then in the afternoon, it breaks away, and there's another Alicia or a Karen or something. Okay, that would be pretty strange. That would be asexual reproduction, susceptible to the same kinds of diseases. Okay, so the purpose of the reproductive system is to produce something new and unique, and... another question I have is, how many sexes are there? Yeah, there's two. Majority of people fall into one or the other. Okay, and how come there aren't three sexes? Or four sexes? I think you can figure this out now. How come there's only two? Or as a matter of fact, why are there two? That would be a good reason to understand. If you know why there are two, then you'll probably have a pretty good idea of why there are not three different kinds of sexes. Yeah, because each gender, all right, contributes to the offspring, and it mixes up characteristics of the father and the mother together to produce somebody new and unique, right? And since we're all new and unique, and if two sexes works 100% of the time, there's no need for a third sex. Because everybody is what? New and unique already, right? And a third sex couldn't improve upon that process because we're all new and unique anyway. Right, so two genders is fine, and that works for plants and animals and people as well. Okay, so I think that's all I wanted to say about that diversification system. So the reason why everything is so complicated in terms of sex, and we're going to look at all these complicated structures, is because that makes us a very strong population because we're all different. Right? That's very important. Okay. One thing I might want to mention, people are becoming really familiar with this right now, but at some point years ago they weren't. Okay, there is a program called Baby Safe LA, and many counties now have this, a Baby Safe program, and it's started in Texas of all places. Okay, and it just says that, does anybody know what the safe haven laws are, baby safe haven? Have you ever heard of such a thing? Raise your hand if, you don't have to tell me what it is, but raise your hand if you've heard of it. A couple of people, but not everybody. So this is good that I'm going to mention it, okay? This program here says that if you have a baby, you can give it up for adoption. The time limit is a little bit different depending on what state and county you're in. Some of it's maybe 24 hours, some is maybe 48 hours. You can give that baby up for adoption if you take it to emergency room, police station, or fire station, and there'll be no any kind of repercussions against the mother or father, right? So you're not going to be responsible financially or ethically or any other reason, and then that baby will be adopted by a family. So why is that important? Because a lot of babies, and I hear about it every once in a while, they find babies in a dumpster, okay? And so a mom is going to have a baby and they freak out and maybe they don't have a lot of support from their family or the father. And the best way that this mom can deal with that situation is by giving birth and then destroying their baby, which is what? Well, that's murder, right? So here is a way to help those people out. And of course, then it is to save those babies from that particular fate. So you can look up some of these laws, babysafela.org, but basically it just says that you can give up your newborn infant and it will be taken care of and you're not responsible for that person, right? So, and then you don't have to kill a newborn baby, so that's really nice. And you can see these signs in like emergency rooms, fire stations, police stations. We don't have any here on campus, but everybody should know about this. Not that you would do such a thing, but you know, it's a really stressful time when you're having a baby, especially when you're delivering. You might know somebody that's related to somebody else, and you should pass that word around, okay? So that doesn't ever happen to anybody. Okay. So he said there were two genders. Any questions on that before I talk about these two different genders, two different sexes? No? Okay. So we said two different sexes. We got male and female sexes. And which one should we talk about first? The most important one, male. Here we go. Male reproductive system. Okay. We want to break the male reproductive system down into primary reproductive structures and secondary. And we've done that a lot in different parts of the anatomy, like vision, right? There are accessory structures for vision, like eyebrows, eyelashes, and then you have photoreceptors in the retina that would be the primary organs. All right, so for reproduction, the primary reproductive organs would be the testes, right? And the testes, generally, we call that a gonad. And a gonad is not a male or female term, it's just a general term. A testes is a gonad, particularly for a male. And you probably know what the gonad is for a female. What is a female gonad? It's an ovary, right? So ovaries and testes are analogous kinds of structures. So the job of the testes is to make sperm and also to synthesize and secrete hormones. The male hormone is testosterone. And that produces these secondary sex structures. Testosterone is important for developing these other kinds of these secondary reproductive structures. All right, so spermatogenesis is the production of sperm. And sperm is a cell, but it's not like the rest of the cells in your body. it has half the number of chromosomes compared to all the cells in your body. A normal cell has 46 chromosomes, a sperm only has 23. And you'll see why that is in just a second. Okay, so that's what a testes does. We're going to look at some of the structure of a testes. The secondary reproductive structures would be scrotum, okay, and epididymis that goes around the testes, vas deferens, seminal vesicles, prostate, bulbo urethral gland, penis, all right, and all these things belong to the male. So we're going to look at these things. First thing, let's look at a testes. So let's go look at a picture, find a picture. All right, this is a quiz. It's also a exam figure. So here's a sagittal section of male reproductive system. And certainly we see the penis here. Here's the scrotum, and the testes are inside the scrotum. Here is the abdominal wall and pelvic wall. So here's the pelvic cavity. So what can you tell me about the testes? Are they in the pelvic cavity? No, they're in the scrotum. They're external to the pelvic cavity. And the reason why is because the job of the testes right here, one of them, is to produce sperm, spermatogenesis. And spermatogenesis cannot take place at normal body temperature. It has to be lower than body temperature. Right? And so the testes descend into the scrotum. It's a little bit cooler right here. And then normal sperm production can take place. There's also something else. If we have a testes and it stays in the pelvic cavity, and it won't be able to produce sperm, but something else will happen. Chances are it's going to turn cancerous. And of course that means then the death of that individual. Right? So it's really important that these testes, both of them, there are two, bilateral, end up in the scrotum here. And that's not just true for humans, but that's for every mammal. And some of you, it might actually breed dogs or cats or some other kinds of animals. And guess what you check for? After a dog is born, or a cat. If it's a male, you check and make sure that you can find both testes in the scrotum, because otherwise one is going to be retained in the pelvic cavity, and that eventually will mean the death of that really nice animal that you have bred. Okay? And when you have an undescended testicle, it means it's hidden within the pelvic cavity. Sometimes we call that cryptorchidism. So a gonad sometimes is also called an orchid. And does anybody know what crypt means? If you're being cryptic, what does that mean? It means you're hiding information, right? So a cryptorchid is a hidden, it's a hidden gonad someplace in the pelvic cavity. And then you have to find it with imaging and remove it. You can't put it down in the scrotum. You just have to take it out of the body. All right, so here we have the testes in the scrotum, and I see that it has a little sheath over the top of it, kind of curls around the testes. It has a bunch of coiled tubes in this area. That's called the epididymis. This is a special tube where sperm that are immature, they're produced by the testes, they're immature, they go to the epididymis, and they stay there and gain competency. Right, so they learn how to use their flagella. Their flagellum becomes activated. So the sperm is really the only motile cell in the human body. There's no other cell that has a flagellum. And remember, a flagellum is like a cilia, except it's what? It's really, really long. So sperm can swim around anywhere in a watery environment. It just swims. Doesn't really know where it's going. It just swims all over the place. Okay, so let's look at some more of that testes. Here's another view. So we got a nice sagittal section of a testes. And here's that epididymis that I was talking about. This is a site of maturation for sperm. Where sperm are produced is in a seminiferous tubule deep within inside the testes. So I see a bunch of seminiferous tubules. And there are different lobes within the testes separated by this connective tissue that we call septations. Right? But these are the seminiferous tubules. And then the sperm move out into this little straight tubule right here as they are developing, and then into another network of tubes that we call the Reedy's testis, and then finally into a little efferent ductule, right? And that's just leaving the Reedy's testes, and then they end up in the epididymis, right? And they stay there until what happens? Until ejaculation, right? And then they move out of the epididymis. They are put into the vas deferens, and the vas deferens then carries them back up into the pelvic cavity, and they join the urethra, and then they can exit the body through the orifice on the penis right here, the urethral orifice on the penis. All right, so next time we got to finish this up. So sign the sign-in sheet, and we'll finish up talking about these seminiferous tubules next time. Let me turn on a light really quick.